This is CD 17 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains part 1 of session number 14, The Conclusion.
This being the final meeting, it would seem appropriate to do a couple of things. One is to bring together the many disparate points we've covered to give you or us some feeling of closure and to remind us that it has to do with the Bhagavad Gita, for those of you that were wondering. Although the lectures seemed to have a lot to do with my personality and didn't seem to be too technically connected with the Gita, I think that it would be a more reasonable statement to say this course was a commentary on the foundation concepts on which the Gita is built, rather than about the actual shlokas of the Gita too exactly. I've found a very interesting predicament of sharing with each of you the dilemma. Some of you have felt that it would have been nice if the course was about the Bhagavad Gita. And some of you feeling every time I tried to give a lecture about the Bhagavad Gita that why did I just give words? Why didn't we get down to it? And somewhere all that comes together, but it's going to come together in each of our hearts, I suspect. The other thing that seems appropriate for this evening is to deal with reentry for some of you that may be leaving Naropa, or so what? The kind of, well, so what? You know, another pedantry's delight, you know, pedantic delicacy, or is it got some payoff? Do we go anywhere with any of this stuff? Or is it useful, or what now? And towards that, I would like to talk a little later on about what might be called, although I'm not using it in the technical Buddhist sense, the middle path, which is a little this, a little that. Whether the ground rules allow it or not, I do it anyway. Allow my personal stuff to enter in to these gatherings. I've gotten lots of letters from you, many qualitative judgments about me, and I remind you in a way, I think it's becoming apparent to you now, that I am, instead of being a teacher, I am a teaching. That I think that you're sitting through this course, you've seen me agonize over a number of places where I've gotten stuck or where I've become very head-trippy or where I've gotten lost in my devotional trip or where I've moved through levels of consciousness. And probably one of the dominant themes of the notes I've gotten is, well, you're human too. You know, you're just like us. And I don't take that as a put-down, because I don't really define, even though I'm in this role, that I am not one of us doing this journey together. I think that a lot of you came here having read Be Here Now, which was a selected set of tape excerpts from moments when my interaction with an audience got to the place where I wasn't around at all, and the stuff just came through. And that made up the book. And so you read the book and you assume that whoever was connected with that book must be who those words are. But when you come here, you see that the words come through now and then, but also there's all the rest of the stuff. There's the personality and the ego and the insecurity and the zeal to please you and all the stuff, you know. Those of you that have been pained by the fact that there is somebody up here that's still working on himself, it's okay. So that I am very happy being an arrogant, confused charlatan who has lost God. It's the way the puck skids. Bounces, yes. There is a quote from the Divine Comedy by Dante, which says, I have been in that heaven the most illumined by light from him, and seen things which to utter He who returns hath neither skill nor knowledge. For as it nears the object of its yearning, our intellect is overwhelmed so deeply, it can never retrace the path that it followed. But whatsoever of the holy kingdom was in the power of memory to treasure will be my theme until the song is ended. From Book of Revelations, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. From John, except ye see signs and wonders, ye will not believe. From Uspensky, but I had seen myself, that is, I had seen things in myself that I had never seen before. There could be no doubt about it, and though afterwards I became the same as I had been before, I could not help knowing that this had been, and I could forget nothing. Now, in the 11th chapter of the Gita, Krishna shows Arjuna his cosmic form, which is awe-full, full of awe. And it clearly blows Arjuna's mind. And the result is that any doubts that he had left are overridden, and he surrenders into it. And then from then on, Krishna starts to give him much more direct instructions. The whole seduction is over, if you will. When I've talked about psychedelics in here, I've often talked about an experience I had, a vivid experience. And in some way, many people get concerned that I am tending to make experiences seem very special and necessary. And I think that in a way, I must honestly honor that the intense experiences that I've had either with my guru or with psychedelics or through meditations or in living daily life have profoundly altered my spiritual journey. The predicament, of course, is clinging to them as memories or using them to make other people jealous or conveying the idea that they're necessary. Sadhana can be very humdrum. It doesn't have to be quite that melodramatic. For example, when there's singing going on, some of you are just singing and some of you are in ecstasy. Someone who's just singing looks at someone who's in ecstasy and says, I wish I were in ecstasy, but I'm just singing. Okay. But in fact, the game is only going to work when, if you are just singing, you just sing. The desire to either have somebody else's experiences or to repeat an experience you had before becomes a very subtle trap. Not so subtle, but a trap. And I think that we should have the courage to be able to honor our experiences and let them go. And when I repeat them, it is to share with you the way in which experiences are functional, but they are most functional when the thing happens and then you let it go without clinging to it. Because almost everybody in this room has experienced being more in the Tao or more in harmony or more connected at one point than you are at a later time. And there is a general feeling among many of us at that moment that we've fallen out of grace, or that we've blown it, or that we want to get it back, or that where can we get the next trip, or whatever way you want to say it. And I think that what Maharaji said to me about the LSD, that it allows you to come into the spirit, but you can only stay, and then you've got to leave again because it's your karma to leave. But it gives you the faith in the possibility so you can get on with the work. And the understanding of those gifts of grace, Aldous Huxley used to call it gratuitous grace, is to take them, allow them to become part of you, and then go on and not look back. Not look back. If you let go of all the highs you've had and just be here at this moment, just letting go of that stuff that you cling to so much, of how high I used to be, how I, oh, wow, if I could only get back there. Because that's the place that keeps you from ever getting back there. And there is no back there. It's all right here anyway. Now, those experiences in the sequence of the Gita come to Arjuna after, A, he is already sattvic. He's Rajaso Sattvic in the terminology of the Gita's individual difference categories. If you recall, the Rajasic is the fiery, active, assertive, I am a doer. the Kshatriya warrior. The Satwig is the very pure, moving towards the light, seeking the truth quality, and he's a combination of both of these. And he's already Satwig, and we are coming out of a very Rajasic culture with some Tamasic overtones. I gave those lectures on non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, non-lusting, non-getting caught in giving and receiving, because all that is stuff that's assumed in Krishna's dealings with Arjuna, but for us, we have to re-examine it all, because we're just getting, we're in a different age period. We're not in the yuga that Krishna and Arjuna were having this dialogue in. And that cosmic form experience of chapter 11 is also coming after a certain amount of wisdom has been laid on Arjuna by Krishna. And if you recall, we talked about the lower and the higher wisdom. And what all this is that we've been talking about is the lower wisdom. This is the stuff that your intellect, your ordinary intellect, can play with, manipulate, conceive of, conceptualize. The higher wisdom is the wisdom that only comes through intuition. It only comes through your becoming it, through your direct experience of it. So the lower wisdom that the Gita presents in the first few chapters, plus the purifications, are the groundwork or the framework for you to be open to the possibility of certain kinds of experiences. What happened to many of us through psychedelics, and I don't know how many I'm talking to of that group here, but I gather it's a large number, was that we had chapter 11 before we'd read chapter 1 through 5. See? And we are left with this mind-blowing vision without any structural understanding or any degree of purification. And that's part of what all the bad tripping is about, because we're in the midst of such heavy karmic predicaments when we choose to blow our minds. And I think as time has gone on, all of us have gotten to be a little more, because what those visions did, we did it the fierce way, really. They forced us to go back and seek the wisdom and also to seek the kind of purification so that the launching pad starts to be different. Because all of those chapter 11 things may be familiar to you, but you probably didn't have them just by sitting out on the battlefield. Probably they had something to do with your chemistry. And when you override your existing habits, there is a karma-uppance from it. I'm not into a good and evil guilt trip. There is just a karmic effect from your desire to override where you are. The greed to get to the light has its cost. I'm not talking about cost that you're bad or anything like that, but merely that you have to deal with all the psychological effects of not being able to be what you have experienced, which has certain depression connected with it. And in a way, the yoga that has been emerging in America is not exactly the sequencing that the Bhagavad Gita talks about. But now that we are beginning to have blown ourselves out of our total philosophical, materialistic, externalizing, worldly predicament, or have been blown out of it by the media, or blown out of it by our burning out through affluence, we are now ready to hear the stuff that we need to hear to get it together so that we become the statement of the higher wisdom, or moksha, or liberation, the liberated being. There is a paradox involved in what we find, because the suggested wisdom is that we are, the way we are structured, or the way this model is, we have senses, lower mind, ego, the buddhi or the soul or the higher mind, and then there's the atman within. There's the whole spiritual dimension in each of us. So that in a sense, each of us is totally the Buddha. Each of us is totally perfect. Well, if it is all perfect, and we are perfect, and everything is just right the way it is, and Maharaji keeps saying it's all perfect, then why do we sit and talk about methods? Like what's to do? That does seem paradoxical. But I think it's only paradoxical if you can't up-level at one level and realize that the perfection includes the use of the methods. That is, you can realize there is nothing to do, and in the state of total space or openness to all possibilities in your life, you then intuitively feel drawn towards meditation. And it's not out of I ought to, or I should, or I must, or in order to get there I'll do this. Those are all levels of work on oneself, but later the motivation for doing sadhana just gets purer and purer. If there's any doubt in you as to why you're doing your sadhana, stop it. Don't do your sadhana. Go back and live your life just the way you lived it before you ever heard the word sadhana, before you ever turned on, before you knew anything about any of this nonsense. Okay? Just live it exactly and forget the whole business. And you will notice how you are drawn certain ways. You begin to be drawn certain ways. And if you can just quiet down the oughts and the shoulds and the whole Protestant ethic trip, you will begin to see that you are further out than you thought you were. Because you keep thinking you have to get behind yourself and push. And actually you're being propelled full speed. Right? And if you don't believe it, just try to stop. I mean, I'm challenging you in that sense because I challenge myself that way. I say, okay, the hell with it. And lo and behold, I get sucked right back in. Okay? For those of you that were uncomfortable with the concepts of reincarnation and karma at the beginning of the course, by now you've either bowed into it, or at least you're setting aside your judgment and letting the play go on. Because most of the Gita is based on the assumption of the transmigrating of beings until you are done, until there is nothing more to transmigrate. That is, there is some predisposing set of tendencies which keeps manifesting lawfully, karma creating more karma, creating more karma, creating more karma, until the awakening process occurs to the point where we cool out our scene, where our actions are not done with attachment, and we therefore are not creating more stuff that we've got to keep plowing through, and the dance gets lighter and lighter, and it all starts to become transparent. And we're still doing our dance, but our egos are less intrusive all the time. We are more dancing lightly. We're learning how to walk without touching the ground. And towards that end, we talked at great length about karma yoga and the different styles and levels at which you do karma yoga. Like if you hear in this class, gee, I ought to do karma yoga. So you go out and do it as I ought to do karma yoga. You will do it with guilt and anger and all kinds of things. And that will drive you to reflect deeper on it. And as your wisdom gets clearer, your karma yoga will change. And like every reason for each act keeps changing. If you'll just watch, take any act you're doing in life and watch it over a period of about 6 months or a year, you're going to watch that the meaning of why you're doing it keeps changing. It isn't that the acts change, it's who's doing them changes and how much you're hooked on them so that you may actually not lose a step in your dance. Some people say, do I have to drop out? There is no drop out, obviously. You may or may not be able to transmute the way in which you do an act while continuing to do the act without ever losing a step. Or you may not. Only you know. Only you know. And the highest statement of karma yoga we got to was the full understanding of the concept of sacrifice. And if we look at sacrifice going in both directions, we see that Krishna comes onto the physical plane as an avatar, which is the Purushatma, the highest Krishna, offering as an act of sacrifice to manifest, to reinstitute the Dharma on the physical plane. So the sacrifice has come down to us, and then to complete the cycle, and to close the ring, and to make the whole thing sacred, or living in the spirit, or back in the Garden of Eden, we offer our lives and the whole thing back up in sacrifice, and the whole operation of formless into form into formless becomes just one huge swaha, one huge offering into the fire of this transformation that's going on. And if that's all too romantic for you, you can work with sacrifice as just sacrificing what you do every day to your higher consciousness, sacrificing it all to your awakening by taking everything you do all day. If you're driving, to me, if I'm driving a car, if I'm getting gas, if I'm making my bed, if I'm brushing my teeth, if I'm going to the toilet, whatever it is, it's all grist for the mill of awakening. Every act in the world can be looked at in a worldly way, or it can be looked at from another vantage point that keeps tending to redefine who you are and what you thought you were doing. And the process is recreating your universe, recreating the whole perceptual field by taking each act. Like, I took the people I used to have really fierce times with, that I'd really almost hate, and I got pictures of them, and I stuck them on my puja table, and I started to worship them. And my heart was hardened. And Maharaji had said to me, whatever else you do with another human being, don't put them out of your heart. Do whatever you got to do with somebody. Scream at them, throw them out, but don't put them out of your heart. Okay? And I'd sit with that being that I didn't like until I could let go of the anger and refocus and reperceive and see that being. And that was, I was taking the toughest ones to work with. And if you can see the way I'm playing my game, it is to get as close to the fire as I can. I mean, like those of you that were around this afternoon, we'll see an example of me walking as close to the fire as I can. Right? And it's hot. You know, it was a hot room in here. It was hot. Perhaps we've clarified a little bit in the course the meaning of renunciation, and that what it isn't a the how holy can you look and how much can you renounce in terms of I've given up sex and I've given up milk and I've given up meat and I've given up, you know. That isn't really the trip, because you are so attached to giving up all those things, you haven't even begun to renounce renouncing. And in a way, the only game to renounce, you have to renounce your suffering, you have to renounce your trying, you have to renounce your renouncing. There's nothing wrong with doing tapasya, it's called, or austerities, but just be conscious as you're doing them, because the levels at which you're doing them will keep changing. And keep bringing them to examination at what level you're doing tapasya. It's really good to impose disciplines on yourself when you feel like that's what you crave. If you crave, it's good to fast, because you begin to see how tripped out you are on food. You bring to consciousness by tapasya the degree of your attachments. But the game isn't to end up seeing how little food you can eat, how little sex you can have, how few clothes you can wear, how little money you have. That isn't what the end point of the game is. The end point of the game is to be free from being attached either to having it or not having it. When Maharaji said to me, don't touch money, it isn't because money's bad. It's because my attachment to money was hanging me up, so that I was oriented around money. The minute you're free of attachment, then you can use or not use anything in the universe. It's all yours to use. All the energy is free energy to use. Because when you are without attachment, you are without desire. And when you are not attached to your desires, and when you are without desire, why would you do anything anyway? You would only do it if it were within the Dharma, because there's no personal trip you're on. And it's far out, because you had all these no-nos in your head because you wanted everything so bad. And then as you start to want it less and less, you find yourself working with things before you wouldn't have imagined you could ever work with again, and working with them in a clear, light, effective, useful way. Because you begin to realize it's your dharma to do it, without it being because you want it or you don't want it or you're afraid of wanting it, and all the whole melodramatic part of the trip starts to pass by. We opened the door through kirtan and through slides and through quotes and so on to the matter of devotion as well as we could in a course of this nature. And this afternoon we dealt with the issue of bhakti a little bit, because what the Gita offers is an understanding of a kind of bhakti that is just incredibly spacey, really. And a lot of the put-down of bhakti concerns what's called lower bhakti, which is almost like idolatry or worship of somebody out there. And it's out of needful attachment. There's nothing wrong if you understand, if you keep developing your wisdom. You really need wisdom so you don't get trapped in lower bhakti. But when that combination of gyan and bhakti goes together at the early stages, that bhakti, that devotion, keeps shifting and getting more and more clear. And as your attachment falls away, so you are more residing in the Brahmanic state. So you aren't around so much. When you have taken a bhakti stance, you go right through the emptiness and you come into a loving dharma. And this is the part where the Gita contributes something that none of the other spiritual paths that are being presented to you at Naropa offers. Because it's saying, first of all, that your heart is a very critical vehicle in the opening of your being. That you're not going to head trip your way through so easily, as it says in the Gita. That's the tough road. And most people can't do it. Do it with love and with the heart. And the difference between the Theravadin orientation at Nirvana and what has been presented in some of the other courses as the Mahayana, Vajrayana, and Tantric extensions, or next steps, if you will, where the being becomes the Dharmic statement, that all is very directly related to this devotional stance. Because I started out feeling this incredible love for this being, Maharaji, on a personal level. It was this guy who was loving me and taking care of me and feeding me and clothing me and patting me on the head and pulling my beard and giving me great teachings, and I'd never been loved like that before. And my heart opened at the very romantic level of I just love Big Daddy. And through that love, I opened myself so that every teaching he was laying on me was just pouring right into me because my heart was so wide open. And in the course of that wide openness, the teachings that came in kept redefining my existence to the point where my attachment to him as a form and that level of love started to fall away and there was something else in its place. I think I described to you sitting in Kosani in a meditation room and first looking at his pictures and then they meant nothing and then feeling his presence in the room and then feeling that in really close and then suddenly feeling empty and then realizing that it had gone inside and experiencing it spatially, if you will, first from senses like seeing a picture, then through vibration and then through inner presence. And at that point, the love has been the vehicle to opening, and as you get emptier and emptier and emptier, the loving orientation towards beings and things and God and Guru and Self makes you wide open to hearing the law, or even, might say it more profoundly, becoming a statement of the law, becoming a statement of the Dharma. And in a way, that's what the emphasis of this course is about. The use of that heart place. That's why the singing is not just, well, let's have fun before we go home to bed. That is a yogic technique. And if you try getting into chanting in your own lives and start to do these kind of all-night chants, you will watch yourself go through level after level after level where your heart will close and it will open in a new way and then it'll feel dead and then it'll all start to reorient and it'll keep changing and changing and changing and you'll begin to appreciate the incredibly sophisticated nature of devotional practices. That they aren't as this kind of gauche melodramatic stuff that we culturally tend to lay on them. The quality of mindfulness, which you develop through the meditative techniques that Joseph has been instructing you in, and that you've been learning through other vipassana techniques, has an analog at a more gross level, which Gurdjieff calls self-remembering. Now, this is a much more gross level, but it's a beginning. And I'd like to talk a moment about what's called the witness, because a lot of people get very tripped out about this issue of the witness. As you begin to become a little more understanding of what the dance is about, you start to notice your own trip more. And there is a type of noticing at first that is very judgmental, because it's got a standard. You've got Buddha in your mind, or Christ in your mind, or Maharaji in your mind, or Krishna in your mind, and then you've got your own behavior, and you're constantly setting them up next to one another and judging your behavior against this and in attempt to bring them together. The problem is that your judging is very emotionally loaded. It's what's known as the superego, and it's a real heavy emotional trip, which tends to lock you into the predicament you're in. It doesn't free you very much. So that if you're going to use the witness as a device, which is a very tricky device to use, what it is, the witness at the self-remembering level, the way Gurdjieff uses it, is one part of the ego which is watching all the other parts of the ego. And it's the part of your ego that isn't judging, that's another part, it isn't trying to change anything, it isn't even looking at anything, it's just seeing it all. It's not trying to get you ahead. It's not trying to change anything. And in a way, one of the first instructions in sadhana is give yourself space, meaning create a spacious environment, which is this witness, a space in which you can notice your trip. First, notice it. Don't try to change it. Don't do anything. Just notice it. Because you will find that a lot of your stuff has only been able to survive unnoticed. And the minute you begin to bring it into the light of this eye, which is just looking at it, it all starts to change without you having done anything. All you did was start to identify with this other part of your ego to watch the rest of your ego. It is definitely ego tripping, right? And there are confusions because there are different levels of what are called the witness. When Krishna says, I am the witness, I am the knower of all the fields, that's a different witness. That is not an ego witness. That's not an intellectual exercise. That is the Brahman. That's the place where you know it all because you are it all, because you've merged. It's out of the oneness that that wisdom comes. That's the higher wisdom. That's the true gyan. But what you're doing is using that little W witness, that little technique of just noticing your dance. Like I sit here and suddenly I move my hands and I was just aware of that movement of hands. And I can say, what are you moving your hands so much for? That's a judgment. If I can say, well, now that you've noticed it, you'll stop. That's a program. But behind judgments and programs, there's just moving your hands or hands moving. And in a way, one of the ways in which you sacrifice is to sacrifice being lost as the experiencer by developing the witness. You sacrifice into the witness. Because at any time, you can become this part of your ego which is just noticing it all very placidly, very calmly. And as that part builds up in its percentage of time in your life, the whole meaning of all of your desire system starts to change. But you will find as you try to do that, as you start to notice the witness inside, which has been there all along, or invest in it, that every time you get near a desire system where the seeds aren't cooked, screw the witness, I want to be the desire. Like I'm desiring as I walk down the street until I suddenly see the tobacco shop that has the tobacco I want. And then I'm busy getting the tobacco. Or we desire right up to the point where the foreplay begins. Then I'm the experiencer. Now we're talking totally within a dualistic framework at this moment. The witness is still witnessing something. Later on, there is a whole other kind of pervasive perception of it all, but that comes out of non-attachment. That comes when you've given up attachment. At that point, you are witness. And you are also enjoyer, and you are also experiencer, and you are also total participant, and there is no part of it that you aren't. But you got to move step by step. And as such, in an early stage, that witness is useful, but later it's got to go. In the course of sadhana, you, if I can assess or share with you who we are here, since I see a lot of you individually, or have in the course of this time, some of us feel the beginning of something. Some of us feel like we're away from it. Some of us don't know what to do next. There's a lot of confusion. If you will keep in mind a few things. One is relax. It doesn't really matter which thing you do, because whichever thing you do next, you will bring to bear whatever consciousness you have available at this moment, and thus it will become the next teaching. And it isn't the thing you do, it's who's doing it anyway. So it isn't quite as melodramatic as all that. And the next part of the strategy is start to learn to listen and trust an intuitive sense of what you are about at any moment. And it may take you in some very unexpected avenues. Like, for example, I bet a large percentage of the people that are going to into monastic retreat for a few months with Rinpoche a few years ago wouldn't have even entertained the possibility of doing a thing like that. Can you imagine going and sitting 10 hours to meditate day after day? And suddenly it feels right on. Feels just right on. And I think that what we're developing in this country are opportunities for monastic and seclusion experiences where you are not making a total life commitment. You're just using it as a vehicle because you need it, and you may need to pull back at some point from your dance enough to be able to hear your inner voice more deeply. Like this fall, I'll be going to Ceylon and to India and be sitting for a month here and a month there and doing Theravadin Buddhist meditation. Last year I went to a Zen retreat. Before that I went to a Benedictine monastery and spent some days going through the offices and just sitting in my cell and being quiet and eating with the brothers in the refectory. And I don't know whether I told you that story. We weren't allowed to talk. And we were standing in line to wash the dishes, which was the only time when you were in line you could talk. And there was a brother right behind me. And you soap at the dish and then you put it in a clear thing with another thing. And he was soaping his dish. And I leaned back and I hadn't spoken to any of these brothers since I'd gotten there. And I said to him, "How long have you been here?" And I was looking at his hand going around the dish. And the answer was 16 years. And it blew me out. You know, for 16 years he had been doing literally that. You know, every single day. There's no Sundays off. Yeah. Now I say, well, that's not my trip. See? At the same moment, the way in which he said that, the kind of calmness, the presence, I had an immediate take of all the parts of Christ's body, that he was as much part of our dance, that his existence in our culture was as important as any other part of the dance. Each person had to hear, you know, his just doing that, like the effect that had on me, which the effect it's having on you, which, you know, and all he was doing was turning that brush, you know. And that's at a gross level of the way the effects work. So I think that instead of pre-programming how you think your trip's going to be, it's best to listen intuitively and keep being straight. The predicament you'll often get into is you will be find very seductive some sadhana or other. At least I have found that. And you go into it, and you go into it with this total commitment, and you drink deeply of it, and you begin to experience the finiteness of it for you. Now, what most people do at that point is they start to build defenses against it, and they start to look for ways to be critical of the method. I think a more sophisticated way of saying the thing is, I have no more work to do here. Not that it isn't beautiful and I'm not beautiful and all that. We just don't have any more work together at this time. And you've got to trust your heart, because often your teachers are going to say, don't leave, and if you leave, all hell's going to break loose and you're going to fall into hell and you're going to lose everything you got, and don't worry about it. Scary though it may be. You've got to keep trusting. At some point, you knew to go to the teacher because of your heart, and if your heart says, go on, go on. There's nothing wrong with leaving somebody and coming back 5 years later and say, well, I made a mistake. Mistakes are absolutely a necessary part of the process. It doesn't get you there any faster to avoid making any mistakes. The best is to just plunge head on in, keep leaping, get to the end of the diving board and dive, and then you get what you can and then go on. And the monasteries or the communes or the retreats that are very beautifully now complexly described in the New Spiritual Community Guide, because see, that now, for example, is another traditional in Hinduism, the method of the pilgrimage. In fact, most of us, when we are in India, are doing pilgrimages. We're going to visit this temple, that holy man, going to sing by this river, take a bath here. There are sacred routes through India. There are other kinds of routes in India too. There's the Goa, Kathmandu, Banaras circuit, which is imposed on those as spiritual pilgrimages too. And now in America, we're starting to develop those. And you now coming to Naropa and then going on to this or that, you are part of spiritual pilgrimage. And if you begin to recognize that as a method, not as an exception to your rule, or not because I'm so disoriented, I don't know where to go. That's it. You know, that disorientation and that moving around through this and that, that is the method. You are doing it. When you stop by a commune and you go in and you find out that on the catalog it says, this group is living together in love and sharing economics, and you go in and they're fighting like hell and they've just had some wife swapping and all guilt and anger and everything, and it's lousy and miserable and you hate it and you go out. There was your pilgrimage. It was a great success. Right? And all you can do is thank the guru for having guided you through that one. because another one has fallen. Not that you're trying to undercut each scene, but be open to a lot of your impure idolatry or worshiping or wanting to make it beautiful out there because you feel it's so shitty inside. Because slowly, as you start to cut away that stuff, you begin to realize, look, here, just like you felt about me, look, he's just another one. Then you begin to look at yourself and say, yeah, and I'm another one too, and here we are. And there but for the grace of God go I. The issue of gurus, there's some bit of controversy about that, as you may notice. Krishna makes it very clear in the Gita, keep your mind on me, fixed on me, and do what you do in life. And when he's talking, that particular me is not Krishna the charioteer, it's Krishna the Purushatma. And as far as I am concerned, with no qualifications whatsoever, that if you think you need a teacher, look around and find a teacher. And if you feel you are being guided within, trust it. It's okay. That as far as I understand the law of it all, we are all in grace. That the only thing that falls out of grace is your own mind. Because you think you fell out. And the minute you give up your thoughts, God is always exactly one thought away. And the minute you quiet down your mind, here we are again. Even though you feel at some level you're shucking yourself a little bit, and you'll feel it a little uncomfortable for a while because of the other traditions that you've been working with, if you can start to look at the laws that are working around you as benevolent, and I don't mean benevolent in nice, in the sense of trying to keep you alive or happy, but that is as guiding you through your karma, awakening you, helping you on your evolutionary journey. Because from where I'm sitting, we are all part of an evolutionary journey. And every experience that is happening to us at every moment is a gift of a teaching being given if you have the perceptual stance to perceive it and work with it. And if you don't, it'll work on you anyway, but less effectively than if you were conscious when you're working with it. And the only question you ask about gurus, and it's almost just when we said to Maharaji, how do you know your guru? He just said, is it somebody who can take you all the way? And so when you meet a being where you don't find any edge at all, there's nowhere where that being is, you feel just free space around that being, and your heart is fully open, then I would suggest you go, go, go. But it's not going to be that you're going to go, go, go towards that being because I suggest it. Because the surrender is no surrender. It's a surrender where it would be absurd not to surrender. It's not even an intellectual thing. It's just you can't not do it at the moment that it happens. The whole dance is much more interesting than an intellectual imposition of I ought to do this, I must do this, I gotta do that. It's just more subtle and more beautiful and more warm, more supportive, if you will. And what seems at first a bitter cup of poison later turns out to be very, very beautiful. Because you begin to later be able to incorporate suffering into the whole bag. And when you're talking about death and dying and people going through horrendous suffering things, very awesome. You will be awed when you start to be so unfreaked by suffering without getting into a freaky reaction about it. And at that point, you will start to meet other beings. And when they were in that space, you previously said, oh, they're just defending. Because you couldn't imagine anybody not suffering, not wanting to avoid it, or not hurting under the suffering. And it's incredible to meet another person where there is suffering, and meet very clearly, being to being, and say, right, yeah, and there's suffering, and here we are. Because if you look in your lives, there is not one person in here that isn't a mass of suffering in many, many, many ways. And to grab, I'm having a ball, it's all wonderful, it's all beautiful, that's all true too. But don't push away any part of it, because in there is also that stuff. And don't get cheery holy. Oh, I'm not suffering. It's all wonderful. I have God. You know? Because you're just going to have to give it up into a deeper despair anyway. Witness your suffering. Sit with it. Give it space. It changes. Don't run from it. Don Juan says, don't run from your enemies. Just turn around and deal with them. Yeah, right. Okay. Boy, this hurts. This is terrible. I'm humiliated. Wow, is this humiliation? And boy, am I depressed. Whew, look at this depression. Far out. Yeah. I'm completely caught, he said. Okay. Okay. So you got to play with those little levels of your own mind. Okay. And the attachment, the being hooked on high beings and low beings, and high is better than low, watch it, because it's just sucking you into more polarities. It's just difference. Differences are different. That's all they are. That's all you can say about them. See, at first you look at people that are suffering out there and you say, I'm better than them because I know I'm suffering for God or whatever you say. But you're no better. You're just in a different stage of the wheel. I don't know. When I look at my wheels on my car, I don't say, well, that part of the tire is better than that part. It's just another part of the wheel. And when you get over that kind of spiritual haughtiness or condescension, that's a subtle one that gets into us. When our faith isn't strong enough, we are always busy putting someone else down in order to get ourselves more secure. Don't you wish you were as evolved as I am, said the unevolved person. And when you evolve to the point where you say, I am what I am, then you start to, and it's all right, that's an important thing, it's okay to be just what I am. Then you give space to other people to be what they are, and it's okay for them. But you're going to have to give space to yourself before you can expect to give space to anybody else. As long as you're not accepting your own predicament, you will be busy putting other people down. There's not a possibility you can get out of putting other people down when you have a negative self-concept you're attached to. So may I suggest to you, those of you that I can't do it with individually, that you just look at all of your stuff. Everybody in this room has stuff. Okay? Everybody in this room has things that they keep closeted in their minds about who they are, that are so yich, so gross, so personal, so humiliating, so awkward, so that you would never want to let another person in. And you can run through it here in your own minds without anything, because the question I keep asking people is, if there is anything at all you can bring to mind that would be totally uncomfortable, difficult, embarrassing, obtuse, obnoxious, scary, wild to share with another human being, share it. Go ahead. That's like, don't think of rhinoceros. Because immediately what comes to mind is all your stuff. Oh, God, I pick my nose, or Allen Ginsberg and Paul Krasner are very good at describing all these things that people keep inside, you know. And you start to bring it out because there is a Sikh saying, once you realize God knows everything, you're free. That you really aren't as vulnerable as you think. Somebody comes in and they say, oh, I can't tell him that. And then finally say, all right, I'm going to tell you. Girl will say, I masturbate thinking of my father's penis and I tie my legs together first. And I'm sitting there doing Ram, 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 Ram. And she could have said anything, you know. It's just another thing. Well, what else is new? No? Not, oh my God, no. You better get out because I don't think we can work together any further. Like, what stuff could you possibly have? I mean, do you think you've got stuff that's so special? Really? You really think you've got a corner on the stuff, you know? You know, really? I haven't found one I've been asking this question of people now for 5 years, and I haven't heard anything new. You know, little permutations of this and that. I haven't found one that's freaked me yet. Some of them have, you know, like, far out. But that's about the strongest reaction I get. Yeah. Because from where I'm sitting in my mantra, it's just stuff. It's just stuff. But to me, it's stuff. But to you, it's, you know, it's not stuff. That's my, you know, that's my life you're stuffing. You know. And the process is one of decathecting, if you will, of detoxifying all of these loaded negative things in yourself that are making you build this whole superstructure of I'm no good, but if I look good outside, if I'm charming, delightful, and an achiever, you know, and if I appear to be getting ahead, it'll all be all right, because I'll look into other people's eyes and they'll tell me I'm good, so I will think I am better than I really think I am because of this stuff that if anybody knew, they would really reject me. Okay? So the question is, how easily can you let go of it? I mean, haven't you had enough of those melodramas yet? Just let them go. It's okay. You are lewd, lascivious, lazy, disgusting, disgraceful, perverse, greedy, passionate, hateful, vengeful, despicable. Right, and here we are. See? And here we are. It's the human condition. We are all part, you know, you got to honor it all. You can't push away the dirty stuff to get so pure, because it's always sitting right under the rug, just, you know, these little things just sitting under the rug, and you look down on the rug and you keep trying to make the rug smooth and it just keeps knotting up, and you're just not going to get it that way. Till finally you just let go of your stuff. You don't have to do so much about it, you just got to let it go in your head. Just let it go in your head. It's very interesting that the Buddhist meditation on death that we did, in which we were looking at the repulsiveness of the body, was to offset the lust for the beauty of the body. Another exercise is to examine your own beauty and divinity of being in order to offset this whole negative trip that you're stuck in of the core ego. And that's why it's very interesting to do these kinds of meditations where, for example, you take a being of light and you visualize it out there, and like we were talking about, you then bring it into your heart so it becomes who you are, and you let yourself become a being of love and light. And all the time you're being this being of love and light, what happened to all those negative things? They're crowded or what? But you keep working with them. Keep working with those juxtapositions. They're very useful to work with. The issue of responsibility and dependency. As many of you know, I guess maybe I described it to you, I was in a dialogue with Rinpoche up in Vermont, in which he said to me, what do you do about sorcerers? And I said, what sorcerers? I don't see any sorcerers. I don't do anything about them. My guru takes care of me. It's his business. I love God. I don't know anything about any of that stuff. And Rinpoche said, you're copping out. He says, you must assume responsibility. He actually called me into his room and he said, Ram Dass, these are critical times and we must assume responsibility. And I thought about that and I decided he was putting me on. So I said to him, look, all times are critical, Rinpoche. And God has all the responsibility. What are you coming on to me for? He says, no, you don't understand. Now, what has evolved as we've been working with this concept of responsibility? I've become to have a little deeper understanding, at least at one level. And it really revolves around the issue of free will and determinism. And that is that you live simultaneously with the understanding that both of those are occurring. And that on this plane, in this room, you think you are having choices and you decide to come here. And that's right, and that's happening, and assume the responsibility for that, just like I am assuming the responsibility to be doing what I'm doing now. It is also true that all of this is a totally programmed trip we're all on. We are all just running off our stuff lawfully, and we are each other's karma, and it's all the guru's leela, it's all God's leela, it's all just play. And every now and then you get a flick, or you get into a deeper understanding where you see your own behavior as the movie running off or as the law unfolding and all of your choices and decisions and crises, and you see it all as what will he do next, and you turn the page and it was all written already. And you are in the predicament for a long time of, like in a murder mystery, you are the butler walking into the pantry on page 42. You are also the person that's reading the story and that's read it before, it seems. And somehow, you already know what's going to happen when the butler gets into the pantry. And then ultimately, you accept the responsibility for the fact that you're writing the story. And there are these levels of free will and determinism. It's like a free will sandwich with determinism in between. Like, first you're under the karma, you're in the gunas, you're in nature, and at that level, it is all mechanical mansville and womansville. At that point, you're just running off mechanically. And in that mechanical runoff, you think you're making choices, and make them. That's okay. Then you begin to be more aware, and you see that it's all mechanical. And as you keep going and you transcend the gunas, you come into the Brahmanic state, and you are once again truly free. And the only clause on that is, in that freedom, the only things you can do, because there's no desire within you, the only things you would end up doing are the Dharma. That is, you would end up working within the law, because there's nothing else you would do, because why would you? Who'd want to? You could not work within the law. There are beings in this universe who could, with a thought, bring to an end this entire physical plane. But I think that along with that power has gone the wisdom that they would only do it if that was what was to be done, within a lawful progression of yugas and kalpas and pralaya and so on. So what I'm saying is that I'm getting to the point where I assume responsibility for my dance. At the same moment, I am living in relation to my guru where, as far as I'm concerned, it's all being done to me. And I'm trying to keep both of those going at once. Because before I was caught in rejecting the responsibility and saying he's doing it, and that's because I was afraid of power. And you will notice in the sadhana that as you start to do purification and as you do all this meditation, you start to get incredible power. You get power over your own environment and over other people. And most people, because of all this negative stuff I was talking about inside yourself, are freaked about the possibility they're going to get power because they may really use it. And they are horrified of who they might be. It's like Freud's worst dream. I'll get it and I'll destroy and I'll kill and I'll castrate and I'll just rape, loot, you know. But you have to face the powers as well. And you begin, as you quiet down, after the first rush, when you start to play. Like, I remember when I first started to make clouds disappear. I'm sure many of you have done that. You know, you just lie and you look at a little, you take a nice, low, little cloud, you know, and you beam your thoughts at the cloud, and you just really do a zap, see, and pretty soon the cloud starts to disintegrate and break up. And you're overwhelmed, you got power, and you say to somebody, say, you want to watch me make a cloud disappear? Pick a cloud, pick any cloud, see, okay? But after a while, you begin, if you notice after a while, it'll be quiet, because you get so, you can't help, because you've wanted to have this power so bad, like the power of seduction, to have the partners you'd like, and suddenly you can get anything you want, far out. Where will I start? You know, I want that one, I want that one, and I want two of those, and I want that one twice. Okay. And you keep saying, it's okay, I'm not attached, see? But in a meditative moment, you may notice, you may recall that attached action creates reaction. And you get so that the simple rule of the game of the statement, as you go towards enlightenment, towards liberation, powers will come along the way, let them go. Not you ought to let them go, but you'll figure out that if you don't, it just makes the path that much bumpier. And you will hear that and you'll still play with them, and that's cool too. Just play with them as consciously as you can and watch the karma accrue. And for a long time, you'd rather have the little chocolate bar now than the big chocolate bar later. You want what's known as immediate payoff. Until you begin to get jaded because the immediate payoff isn't fulfilling enough. And all the karmic spin-off from the use of the powers is starting to overwhelm you. And then you just begin to be aware of your own predicament, and that leads you to the next step. It's okay. Play with your powers. It's all right. Just play with them consciously. Try to keep a meditative space going if you can about it. It helps. This is a quote about the Divine Mother from Ramakrishna. I may have read it before, but I like it to read it again. On all sides he found the manifestation of the Divine Mother, the omnipotent Mother of the universe. She was in the water, she was on land. She was the body, she was the mind. She was pain, she was comfort. She was knowledge, she was ignorance. She was life, she was death. He found the Mother in everything that he saw, or heard, or thought, or imagined. She was turning yea into nay, and vice versa. Beyond the body and mind also, it was she, the Mother, in her transcendent, her absolute aspect. Brahman and Shakti were one, two aspects of the same entity. I am talking now about the different aspects of God that the Gita talks about. I would like to read a poem to you that originally Bhagwan Das read to me. It's called I Am the Great Sun. It's a poem that the poet depicts it as being on a Norman crucifix of 1632. I am the great sun, but you do not see me. I am your husband, but you turn away. I am the captive, but you do not free me. I am the captain, you will not obey. I am the truth, but you will not believe me. I am the city where you will not stay. I am your wife, your child, but you will leave me. I am that God to whom you will not pray. I am your counsel, but you do not hear me. I am the lover whom you will betray. I am the victor, but you do not cheer me. I am the holy dove whom you will slay. I am your life. But if you will not name me, seal up your soul with tears and never blame me. Krishna describes the various ways in which the divine being is related or manifests in the universe as that which creates form, as the forms which it's created, as the essence within the forms that it has created. Krishna says, I am also Brahman. I am the formless, beginningless, endless Brahman. In each individual, the spark of that Brahman, the Atman, is me. So Krishna is within each individual. Krishna is each individual. Krishna produced each individual. And behind the Brahman and the Shakti or the Prakriti or the forms, behind that polarity, I am. Recognizing the sacredness of everything, bringing honor, reinvesting the spirit in life, comes through a recognition of all of the ways in which one honors and brings oneself as a sacrifice to God. At one moment, one form is comfortable. At another moment, another form. Just keep flowing in and out of these forms. You'll sit with a river and you'll look at a rock and you will feel its sacredness. At another moment, nature won't do it to you. Sometimes it'll be just a word about Christ that will do it. Or you will feel that spirit, the spark of the spirit in your heart. Or you will get a moment where the intellect will be so clear you will see the design and you'll see the awesome nature of the design of it all. Where in the Hasidic literature it says not a leaf turns but that God controls it. You see the exquisiteness of the law, including your own birth, growth, old age, and death. And when you are quiet enough inside, you wouldn't change a jot of it. You will really recognize its absolute perfection, because it is all God made manifest. And in that recognition is the recognition of your part in it, which as you listen more clearly is very simple, to relieve suffering on every plane wherever you find it. And the ultimate recognition is that the suffering is relieved only by someone who themselves is free. As Ramakrishna said, a man bound chain, hand and foot in chains cannot free another. So that until you are free, let all of your work of life be a sacrifice. You serve to relieve suffering wherever you find it, even until you are free. But until you are free, it is all an exercise designed to bring you to freedom so that you become the Dharma, so that every act you perform is the optimum act to relieve suffering. Because that's what conscious entities are doing here. Because there's nothing else to do. Simple as that. Nothing else to do.